First of all, it's always a pleasure to be in discussion or conversation with John Quellis, as Rupert says. It's rare to find deep thinkers in politics at the moment, so you're one of those, and that's always welcome. So in the article that you read, in the essay that you read, one of the things John's critical of is you call it chronocentrism. People thinking at their own time, their own moment, is kind of super special and super important, which is a fair critique. But the opposite is also a problem, not realising that the moment is in fact specific and particular and singular and things are happening that are different. I think we have to try and hold in our heads at the same time the sense that some things have continuity and some things are changing. I mean, in a way, smart political thinking is always trying to understand what in the present moment is kind of derived from our longer history, what actually is new and what might be coming in the future. I actually think the essay helps do that, helps us focus on some of the particularities of the moment. But what I want to do in thinking in that kind of way, sort of ironically, but is do what I'm trying to do, which is talk a little bit about the historical context of the essay, the kind of trends within left thinking that I see kind of echoing within it, and on that basis sort of help try and clarify some of what is and isn't being argued by accelerationists and others, and disagree with you on some of the interpretations you've made, and then try and think about what that might mean for the future. So, in terms of the context of the essay, obviously at one level you might read it as being about very particular disputes and differences within the left and within Labour at the moment, and in some respects it is, but it doesn't fit neatly into any of the factions or groups, Corbynism or whatever, it transcends those. And I think that's in part because the essay is really touching on and addressing much deeper and longer term sort of theoretical debates within the British left that very few of us remember. But which nevertheless turn out to be having effects in the present. And particularly, some of these go right back to the kind of periods you mentioned, kind of early formations of British socialism in the 19th century. But they particularly go back to 68. A lot of things go back to 68 and the failures of 68. And that includes, on the one hand, a very specific debate about value theory, which you touch on in the essay, and which I promise you I'm now not going to talk about, but we can. I'll just say that in the essay, John is right, Mason garbles it. And that's a problem in his kind of writing. We can talk about that in a different context if you want. What I do want to talk about is a much bigger dispute that was quite big in the UK, in the left, in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s. And it was really a kind of argument between certain currents of British Marxism, those most shaped by a particular sort of historical research, and also by Christian religious traditions of the left in this country. And they were in conflict with certain kinds of European Marxism, French and Italian mostly. I could get really nerdy here, but I'll try and spare you from it. So what that debate was about lots of things, but one of the things it was particularly about was the word in John's title, which is humanism, right? Which is quite a significant issue to be debated. But I think that part of what was going on in that debate at the time, and I think in the essay, is a kind of some misunderstandings and misreadings of exactly what is meant by humanism or by anti-humanism. So let me summarise some of the most bitter and protracted and lengthy and complex debates in British Marxism in 2 minutes for you. Okay. So on the one side in that debate were essentially those who think that politics should and could only kind of properly proceed on the basis of some proper conception of human nature, and for whom socialism, the politics of socialism, should follow from the fact, from the discovery or the fact of the realisation, whatever you want to call it, that human nature is really already socialist. But actually, we are naturally egalitarian in some way, communal, social, rational creatures, right? And once you've got that as a benchmark, you've got a means to criticise societies that are at odds with human nature or compromising human nature in some way, which includes the Soviet and the socialist ones. That was an important part of that debate. And you can propose a politics which is meant to free or realise that human nature so that it can express itself in its fullest and finest form. And that sort of politics, and you did hear the word, generally or often talks about alienation. That's one of its key ethical as well as analytical concepts, alienation as well as certain conceptions of injustice and exploitation. And it often emphasises things like the dignity of labour, the importance of meaningful creative work, social, political as well as legal rights. So that, however, can get expressed in all kinds of different sorts of politics. Part of Corbynism is in that tradition very clearly, I think, yeah? Particularly if you connect it to a certain version of how you understand global and imperial power, you end up with that strand of Corbynism. Blue Labour has a part of it, a certain idea about natural sociality, along with a more theological conception of dignity. But you can even find it in Blairism, the kind of sort of Gerrish type humanitarian intervention is only affected by two. So it doesn't lead to a simple single politics, but it's a core and important strand of British left thinking. They all share in common a kind of sense that politics is about getting rid of something unnatural that's imposed itself upon the natural human condition. So the counterposition is anti-humanism, okay? And that starts with a critique of such conceptions of human nature. What it says is that all those conceptions of human nature are always kind of false abstractions. They're always imaginary constructions, and particularly importantly for this tradition, they are really always a version of the self-image of the particular class that is dominant at the time. So they're ideological, they're mythical in the bad sense, and are therefore a barrier to actually realising a new or different form of society. So that also can issue in all kinds of political positions. Although it's tended in the UK and European context to manifest mostly in avant-garde kind of writing and art and theoretical activity. But it does that in part because it's concerned to try and shake us free of certain what it sees as being restrictive conceptions of what human nature is. In that respect, it's one of the kind of sources of contemporary political movements that critique kind of certain fixed notions of identity, who say there are kind of hegemonic conceptions of what it is to be human, but these are actually expressing certain class or geographical or masculine or whatever it might be, conceptions of identity. So there's not an easy lineage to that route, but that's part of what is going on there. But the thing to understand is that anti-humanist position wasn't anti-human, and in a sense wasn't anti-humanist in the sense that you partly mean it. It wasn't even really opposed to concepts of human nature. It's just that what it proposed was that human nature is something that has a history, and that part of human nature is precisely that, to happen to be part of such a history. That what it is to be human is to be part of the historical discovery, creation, recreation of human beings through their ongoing interaction with themselves, with each other, with nature, and their own nature included. If there are any Marx wonks in the room, that's what the theses on Feuerbach are about. So the key thing is that for that approach, the politics which you get from it is concerned less with alienation and injustice, not that it isn't concerned with those things, and more with power and freedom. And it thinks freedom in a way very different from how it's usually thought within the liberal tradition. Again, to simplify grossly, the argument is that freedom should be understood as the capacity to act in the world, to have the power in that sense to act, and specifically then the power that comes from the combination of our collective intelligence, our collective power, our collective action. So its concern is with how freedom can be increased through the increase of collective power over ourselves. Now that's very different from the arguments you get in individualized identity politics, which is why this approach is very, very different from those. And it does lead to a politics interested in extending human knowledge, including as it is expressed in technology, to get us to the kind of nub of the article. Yeah? But I think in that context, you're wrong to associate it with things like transhumanism. So transhumanism is more to do with the culture of Silicon Valley, certain kinds of philosophers of science with no interest in socialism whatsoever, who think that individuals should and will want to acquire as much unlimited mastery over their bodies, even transcend their bodies in some way and fuse with machines or whatever it might be. That's really much the opposite of a kind of historical materialist focus on human beings being parts of natural and human history and thinking about how technologies can be employed by all of us, not just by individuals. So the sort of position in inventing the future, which you talk about in the essay then, is simply, I think, that scientific technological development, which is always part of socialism, can enhance our freedom in the sense that it helps us escape the kingdom of necessity, to refer to the early Marxist term. So what Williams and Cernicek mean when they talk about synthetic freedom, then, is simply the sort of freedom that my glasses give me to read, even though I have terrible eyesight. But it recognises that freedom is dependent on really rather a complex and rich collective history, which is physical and mental and material, and enhances my power over my eyesight and the things I can see. And we should see that as something that needs to be invested and developed for the collective good of all, and also because that collective investment will enhance and improve those kinds of developments that improve our freedom. So all of that could be quite an arcane debate, and in some respects it is, but it is also linked to trying to understand the past, the present, and what's happening at the moment. And the phenomena that we're concerned with, you've already talked about politically, Brexit, Vyfstra, Jobbik, National Justice Party and so forth, which are in some way linked to wage stagnation, underinvestment, including underinvestment in technology that might enhance and improve collective life, issuing all kinds of fragments of fragmentations of electorates, and the rise of a certain kind of reactionary politics around kind of reasserting distinctions within human natures between genders and races and nationalities and so forth. So I think the question is the situation that we're in just a kind of sharp manifestation of an old problem that modernity and capitalism alienate us and go against our human nature? Or is there something new happening? Are there political phenomenon that we're seeing, are they parts of something more substantive, something more significant? Part of the wager of books like Post-Capitalism and Inventing the Future is that actually there is something more specific going on. There is a deeper level contradiction between, in old-fashioned language, the forces of production, the relations of production, the capacities of this technology to enhance and improve collective power are being blocked. And that's manifesting in precisely this stagnation, this frozen situation, and all the symptoms of destructive politics that that brings us to. But then the question becomes, well, how do we actually think that in a kind of complex way, but also a way that speaks to and appeals to the kind of political moment that you've just described in terms of the progressive dilemma or the nature of the working class? So I think that the analysis actually goes somewhere in the opposite direction, in a sense, to where you saw it going in terms of abolishing the working class. I think it actually potentially makes us rethink and see the working class as somewhat possibly even larger than we might have seen it before. So let me give kind of one example of that. You can see that one of the things that's happening at the moment is what you might call the proletarianisation of the professions. That fields, law, medicine, our own academia are becoming routinised, are becoming precarious as work, and are becoming subject to the kinds of surveillance and monitoring that one might have associated with old style factory labour. Now what that's led to, well, I should say that's in part happening because of mechanisation, because of technologies that can substitute for or reproduce or in some way affect the kinds of knowledge and its use and dissemination that professions rely on kind of holding and perhaps hoarding to maintain their distinct position. That's under threat. Our lectures can be recorded, you can look on a computer to see what illness is, you can get computers to produce your legal documents for you. I'm directly addressing the Vice Chancellor now. So what that's led to, pretty obviously, is new forms of class militancy in the professions. The lawyers are agitating quite a lot around kind of the pay rates they're getting for particular cases, linking it to sometimes linking to social issues around access to the law. Junior doctors, the medics, and of course academics as well, particularly early this year. Strike was about pensions, but it wasn't just about pensions, it was really a reflection of this larger change in the nature of the work that we do. So the question to ask, either us people involved in those professions or generally analysing it, is, well, what's the goal of that militancy and that opposition? Is it seeking to restore a lost privilege? Does it want to protect, return to the scarcity of our product, and so enable us to maintain our above average pay and a measure of elite autonomy that we very much miss? Or is it actually to fully free our knowledge from containment within what are perhaps in some respects arcane institutions, law courts and universities, with rather rigid ideas about how things can and should function, who can know what and how things are supposed to work, the timetables, pathways and curriculum designs that define the university, for instance, the assessment regimes that we employ. So in other words, there's a question there, I think, about how technology disrupts changes, and I shouldn't say disrupts, but alters the kind of class experience of people in their work. In some respects, is throwing up a demand for a return to that kind of privilege, but maybe, and I think this is the wager that you get in Inventing the Future, maybe actually we should be pushing through that moment and realising there's something to be gained by employing that technology in ways that does, in fact, enhance and increase our collective intelligence and collective power, but which looks very different from where we are now. And so that what might seem like a progressive position defending a certain kind of labour aristocracy might in fact not be the really radical transformative position. So that's the kind of political question I think that's being asked and that is very sharply raised in those kinds of books and defines the kind of moment. Are the technological and social changes we're experiencing things we can stop or reverse, get things back to how they used to be? Or actually do we need kind of to think very differently about the kinds of institutions and social forms that might come into being if we articulate our work, our labour and our thinking to those kinds of technologies. What would a university look like if we actually thought, okay, how can we use video and lecture capture and Google and access to all these things and students' interaction in very, very different kinds of ways? Yeah, I'm not sure. All right. My interest as someone towards the end of my career is very much to restore our old privilege and maintain it. But I can also see that there may in fact be benefits in transforming it in ways that resist its capture by a certain kind of old style, profit, cash oriented neoliberalism. Okay, so just to kind of close it off, in that sense, I think there are really kind of pressing questions about the use and social organisation of technology that are very acute, that are in some ways old questions that we've always asked, but also have new inflections that are distinct to our particular context and our particular moment. I think that the kind of the literature on the ethical critique of technology, whether it's in socialist humanism or in things like Mumford and LL and Arendt and so forth, is useful but is not enough, because I think we do have to pose that question in terms of how does technology affect the capacity for the exercise of collective power, and how can we enhance that and realise that. In that context, we do, in fact, agree that there's something very interesting about what McDonald and others are doing in terms of thinking about new ownership models, different kinds of relationships between cash resources and one's relationship to the labour market, all kinds of things going on as people are digging up like the Lucas Plan, looking again at what is it to enable people to be having some kind of control over their labour, but in a context where the goal is some kind of socially collective beneficial advance and some kind of use. So there's all kinds of things on the table. And in terms of this dispute, it's always worth remembering that whatever disagreements we might have about Althusser's theory of humanism, that's not an important division compared to divisions that we might have against those whose politics is very much about repealing all the social advances of the 20th century.